Well, we started a new series last week about decision making and the importance of making good decisions. And we said that the reason this matters is because a lot of life. I mean, we look back at the decisions we've made and the choices along the way, and it's largely led in many ways to where we are right now. Of course, there are things that we can't control and we didn't get to pick, but we did get to decide, and we do, who our friends are, decided who to marry. We decide largely what to do with our time and our money. And what we're exploring is these moments in life when we have to make a choice. And sometimes it's a choice that we don't want to have to make, and in the moment, we're not sure which way to go. I mean, do we take the job? Do we not? Do we say yes? Do we move? Do we take the risk? And as we look at the options, we recognize there's implications. There are times when saying yes to option A is saying no to another choice. And sometimes we have trouble deciding because there are too many good choices. Other times we have trouble because both options seem bad. And often there's fear involved. We don't want to make the wrong choice. We don't want to regret the decision. And this is a challenge, isn't it? We struggle with this. Last week we looked specifically at how, with at least the bad choices that we've made, the things that we regret, one of the things all of those decisions have in common is they did not take place in an emotional vacuum. Like, you look back and there's clearly emotion that was involved in that, maybe driving the decision, maybe even driving it more than we realized at the time. And it clouded our judgment, our ability to see clearly. And we've all had examples of things we've talked ourselves into because of this. Relationships and opportunities and decisions and actions we really had no business getting ourselves into. And in some cases, we only ended up hurting ourselves. Now, what I want to talk about this morning is another time when basically we're susceptible to making bad choices and emotion is still involved, but there's something else that compounds just the raw emotion. It's when life isn't working out like we thought, like we're here, and we thought by this point or whatever that we should be here. And there's a gap between what we desire, what we want, and where we actually are, and we recognize that we're not getting there fast enough. Can you think of any areas like that? And then what happens many times is an opportunity presents itself. And in this opportunity is sort of a promise that if you take this, it'll fast track you. It'll basically shortcut you it'll close the gap. It'll get you what it is that we want. But there's a catch. And you realize, for me to take this opportunity, I'm going to have to compromise something in my beliefs, in my integrity. We find ourselves having conversations with ourselves along the lines of, you know, I normally wouldn't consider doing something like this, but maybe there's an exception in this case. It's a way to get where you want to be financially, but you've got to, like, shh, your conscience. You ever have that? Just sit this one out for a second. It's a relationship that you know is not going to be healthy, but it's like, come on, everybody else I know is happy and in love, and don't I deserve that? And by the way, I'm not getting any younger. We could go through the list. And so throughout your life, you'll be confronted with options that promise to get us where we want to be more quickly, but it involves many times crossing a line that we wouldn't cross otherwise, morally, ethically, in our conscience. And so I want us to look at I think this is a fascinating story, illustration of this from the Old Testament, and we'll walk through this and then talk about where we are in this and how this might apply to us. Now, most of you here, you've probably heard about King David, so like one of the most prominent, sort of well-known figures, kings for sure, in the Old Testament, in Israel's history. So if you have a Bible, I want to invite you to turn with me to 1 Samuel 24. I'll give you a few minutes to find that. Before David was actually on the throne, there was another guy who was king, a guy by the name of King Saul. And King Saul, because you ask, why do we need a new guy? He's not dead. And so King Saul, at a critical time in his life, God said, I want you to go this way, and Saul went the other way. And he disobeyed God, and in the moment, he didn't recognize the consequences of that. And the prophet Samuel goes to King Saul and says, because you disobeyed God, ultimately it's going to cost you your throne. Like, you're not going to reign forever and your kids and sons after that. It's going to end a lot quicker than you realize. And Samuel is then also told by God to go to the household of a man named Jesse, and that one of Jesse's sons, who by the way had no relation to Saul, is going to be the next king. And so Samuel goes, he shows up unannounced at Jesse's house and says, hey, this is the message, bring your sons. We're going to have a little tribal council. And by the way, what an incredible honor for a parent at this time or any time to have your child chosen by God to be the next king. So he brings in his sons. He's got seven of them he brings. And Samuel starts with the oldest, which would have been logical, the tallest, the most naturally gifted leader, the obvious choice. Samuel goes up to him and says, he's not the one. So then he goes to the second son of Jesse, who's, you know, stands up, you know, extra tall when Samuel walks by. And again, Samuel says, nope, I don't like his hair or whatever. I don't know. I made that part up. Not him. Goes down all the way through the line, these seven sons, gets to the seventh son and says, none of these guys are it. That's kind of awkward, isn't it? Because you kind of made this big deal that one of the... And so then Samuel says, I know this is kind of weird, Jesse, but do you have any other sons? That's a weird question. And Samuel says, or Jesse says, actually, now that you mention it, I do. I do have another son. It's kind of an odd... David, my youngest, who I've completely forgot about, he's out in the fields. But listen, Samuel, you don't want him. I mean, he's like, for a lot of reasons, but he's the runt of the family. It's not going to work. By the way, if you're here and you're like in counseling because you grew up in the shadow of your older, like perfect siblings, just know that you're not alone. Samuel says, well, bring him here. Actually, this is funny. He says, and nobody's sitting down until David gets here. Okay, I guess. And so David walks up, you know, what's going on? And as soon as he gets there, Samuel goes, he's the king. He's the one. And you can imagine Jesse and the seven older brothers going, what? Are you kidding me, David? I did not grow up with seven older brothers, or I'm sure I'd be a lot tougher than I am. you can imagine what life was like for him, though, right? Bottom of the ladder. They're always making him do stuff they don't want to do, chores that are like the worst. You know, he probably was bossed around, picked on. Life for David growing up could not have been that easy. And the other thing that's important to know is that in this culture, David's future was already mapped out. Like for David, there was no, oh, what do I want to do with my life, career-wise? There is no upward mobility. No, his father was a shepherd. His grandfather was a shepherd before that, you know, on and on and on. David was going to spend his life tending sheep. I don't think it would have even occurred to him to even daydream about a different life, a different future. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, in an instant, his life is forever changed. David is told that one day, in the not too distant future, he's going to be king. He's going to be in charge. And I think the first thing he thought was, of my brothers, right? But then that sinks in, I'm going to live in the palace. I'm not going to be in charge of just my brothers. I'm going to have influence over everyone and have servants and the best food. I bet it was pretty quiet that night around the dinner table as this soaked in. Now, here's what's interesting. This transition for David doesn't happen overnight. The question is, how will David get from where he is to where he's supposed to be, from shepherd to a king? And we kind of miss this when we read this story. We flatten it a little bit, but there were actually several years that passed between David being chosen to be the next king and then when he actually got to do king stuff. Several years went by. And on top of that, the system that was in place was basically, and certainly from Saul's perspective, Saul kind of had an idea of who was going to be the next king, one of his sons, right? Someone from his bloodline, not a stranger. So the question is, how will David go from shepherd to king? Samuel just says you're going to be king. He doesn't say when, doesn't say how. He doesn't give many details. Well, not too long after this announcement, David ends up, he finds himself serving actually in Saul's royal court, his palace, as one of the musicians or poets of King Saul. He's in the palace. That's a good sign, right? Like, I'm not on the throne, but I'm in the room. So that had to have been giving him some hope. But then later, through David's defeat of Goliath, David becomes a renowned warrior. Word quickly spreads about David's courage and his leadership. And eventually what happens is Saul gets jealous, doesn't he? A couple of times, actually, Saul hurls, with for no reason, just a fit of rage, hurls a spear at David's head and just barely misses him. And at some point, David's going, I don't think he's happy. I don't think he's happy with me being around here. And eventually, Saul just outright runs David out of the kingdom. And David gathers around him basically the misfits and the rejects, and he kind of has this small group of followers. And meanwhile, Saul gets more and more obsessed with getting rid of David, with killing him, basically to preserve his right and his son's right to the throne. I mean, David's in the way, and we've got to get rid of him. Now, at one point, David and his men are out in the desert, hiding in caves, and they're trying to escape King Saul's army, he's out hunting them down. And I want to pause here. Just imagine where David is for a moment. I think this is worth reflecting on. He's been given this promise, you're going to be king. And years later, is he any closer to being king than he was? Not really. I mean, he's really no closer than when he was a shepherd in the fields. I mean, yes, people know him now, and he has a little bit of a following, but he's running for his life, hiding out in caves. And I think for David, probably getting dead is a kink in his life plan, right? Yes. So how in the world is all this going to work out? How is he going to get from where he is now to where he wants to be? So here's where we pick up the story. 1 Samuel 24, verse 1. After Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told, David is in the desert of En-Gedi. Like, we got him. We got a lock on him. So Saul took 3,000 able young men from all Israel and sent out to look for David and his men near the crags of the wild goats. Basically to not just arrest him, but to kill him. Right? Because you don't really go on a manhunt with 3,000 men against one or a small group, unless you mean business. Verse 3, he came to the sheep pens along the way. A cave was there, and, important side note, Saul went in to relieve himself. That's funny, right? I mean, the Bible is honest, and I think that's supposed to be funny. David, look at this. David and his men were far back in the cave. Uh-oh. Now, this is where things, I don't know if you're superstitious or not. I can be, the right thing, circumstances, right? This is where things get superstitious really, really quickly. Let me ask you this. What are the odds? What are the odds that this would happen, that Saul would randomly and unknowingly walk into this cave where David and his men, by himself, where David and his men were already hiding? I mean, you hear that phrase, sometimes people say, this is like a God thing. But this, right? I mean, the stars have aligned. Like, it doesn't get any more perfect than this. There's no way this is just a coincidence. Verse 4, the men said, I'm assuming quietly, this is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, I will give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish. So David, obviously, he told the guys about the promise and the future, and they knew what David was called and destined to be, and they're saying, David, look at this. Look at this opportunity. And not only that, but there's a way to accomplish all of this with really minimal bloodshed, just not any of us, just King Saul, who deserves it. It's a pretty dramatic moment, isn't it? I mean, if this were a movie, like if Tarantino was able to film this, here's what it is. Exterior shot, cave, men standing around. Saul disappears into the darkness, and there's a long, unnecessarily long silence. And then David walks out carrying Saul's sword. Boom! I mean, that's awesome, right? That's awesome. That's almost supernatural, just lining up perfectly. So I just want to say, if there's ever been a set of circumstances pointing to something, because we all have that, don't we? The circumstances, it's obvious what we should do. This would be that situation. And it seems that David saw it. That's how he saw it. The next verse, he says, Samuel writes, "Then David crept up unnoticed." This is almost too easy. Just again, pause. What would you do in this situation? I think I know what I would do. But as David got close, he realized there was something wrong. He felt like a twinge of something, maybe some tension, some uneasiness. Something was just a little bit off. And what's amazing to me is David didn't just go, "That was weird," and then continue doing what he was going to do. You realize all the momentum in this scenario is in carrying this plan forward. The stars have aligned. All his guys are going, you know, they have to be quiet. You know, he's got all the reasons in the world to carry forward. I mean, he's been nothing but loyal, by the way, to Saul. He doesn't deserve what Saul's doing to him. And with all the emotion and all the adrenaline and all the feelings of like, this cannot be a coincidence. This is meant to be. David does something that I think is almost hard to believe. You know what he does? He pauses. Like knife in the air behind Saul's back, and he stops. He pauses. And at this point in the story, we all have something in common with David. Because we've all been in situations where we have to make a choice, and we have an opportunity to get exactly what we want. And our friends, the people around us, are telling us, by the way, the friends that we chose, are telling us, go for it, that this is you. And the circumstances are maybe lining up perfectly, and it's like, oh my goodness, this is meant to be. But in the back of our mind, there's this little annoying ping of our conscience. There's the slightest bit of tension or uneasiness, and we don't even know where it comes from. We have this inner sense of like, something about this relationship doesn't seem quite right. And this tiny sense of uneasiness, like the deal seems almost too good to be true. Like it looks good on paper, but something is off. And here's the deal. It's in these moments when we are on the verge of making a decision that's going to send us in a new direction. We don't fully know what the consequences are in these moments. I mean, in this moment of choice, we actually don't fully know what's going to happen. All we can see is maybe the next step or two. At most, we don't even know what hangs in the balance. And so I just want to say we're not even trying to apply this yet. So if you're uncomfortable, we haven't even got there. Without even applying it yet, I just want to stop and point out that from this story, we learn that we can make seriously bad decisions with our life and at the same time have almost everything around us encouraging us to do that. Isn't that kind of sobering? Which means the circumstances can line up and our friends and the people around us are in our corner and logically we've kind of worked it all out and all of that stuff, that weighs pretty heavy. And the only thing, many times in these moments, the only thing running contrary to that, the only thing contradicting all of this weight and energy and momentum, here's what it is. Just a small hesitation. Just a tiny bit of tension. And that's it. No sirens going off. No vivid warnings in dreams. Nope. Just a little bit of tension, a little bit of hesitation, of uneasiness. And how easy is it to ignore that when you've got all this? It's pretty easy, isn't it? Pretty easy to blow past that and just go with the momentum, to just go, bloop, right? That's all it takes. And the whole plan is set in motion. David crept up unnoticed and cut off a corner of Saul's robe. That was actually that was actually a threat to the king, you know, his person, his body. So he kind of went, that's considered an attack in some ways. Verse 5, afterward, David was conscience stricken for having cut off a corner of his robe. Verse 6, he said to his men, The Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lay my hand on him, for he is the anointed of the Lord. And the guys are going, David, why are you hanging on to this old way of thinking? Your master, the Lord's anointed, have you seen how he treated you? They're dumbfounded that David would say this. Verse 7, with these words, David sharply rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul. And Saul left the cave and went his way. So in spite of the pressure, in spite of the signs, in spite of his anger, David refused to ignore the obvious, that God had placed King Saul in that position. And David, in this moment, recognizes that maybe I shouldn't be the one to replace what God's put there, what God's put in place. Maybe that's still actually murder. And then verse 8, then David went out of the cave and called out to Saul, my lord the king. When Saul looked behind him, David bowed down and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. He said to Saul, why do you listen when men say, David is bent on harming you? This day you have seen with your own eyes how the Lord delivered you into my hands in the cave. Some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, I will not lay my hand on my Lord because he is the Lord's anointed. See, my father, look at this piece of your robe in my hand. I cut off the corner of your robe, but did not kill you. Verse 12, may the Lord judge between you and me. This is huge. David says, I'm going to trust God to deal with the outcome. I'm just going to do the right thing. And what I'm going to try to do is listen to that tiny, rational, irritating voice within me. He says, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me, but my hand will not touch you. Saul, I'm not going to use your wrong to justify me doing the wrong thing as an excuse. And then finally, verse 15, he says, may the Lord be our judge and decide between us. May he consider my cause and uphold it. May he vindicate me by delivering me from your hand. That's amazing, isn't it? Saul feels like an idiot and leaves. And seven chapters later, he's battling the Philistines. And an archer lifts his bow in the air, fires a random arrow, aiming at, you know, Saul's bodyguards. And the arrow hits King Saul and pierces his armor and severely wounds him. And King Saul, recognizing it's over and doesn't want to be humiliated, shortly after that, he falls on his sword and dies along with his sons. And then David becomes king. Boy, talk about a winding path to actually get there, right? That's a long way to get from the thing you were promised years before. I mean, as a shepherd, he's going, how do I get from a shepherd to the palace? And then he's in the palace going, okay, I'm here as a musician, but still, I'm nobody. And then after that, he's going backwards. He's in the desert. He's running, hiding for his life, running from King Saul, going, how am I supposed to get from where I am to where I think I need to end up? In this one critical moment, because David couldn't see any of that throughout this process, in this one critical moment, David has the opportunity to take his future into his own hands. It was the perfect shortcut. Perfect circumstances, friends backing him up, so easy to justify. But David knew that if he did that, he'd be crossing a line that he couldn't uncross. Here's my question. What if David had done that? What if he hadn't paused and listened to that hesitation within him, his conscience? What if he had killed King Saul? We don't know for sure, but I suspect that he wouldn't have been king. I mean, Saul's being removed because he disobeyed God. So I suspect that would have had consequences for David. At the very least, it would have had consequences that he, in the moment, had no ability to fully think through or to fully see. So for us, when there's something that we want, and it's something that we feel like we deserve, that, you know, and many times these are good things, right? When there's that desire combined with circumstance, like when the circumstances conspire to give us the thing that we feel like we deserve and just haven't been able to get, I'm just saying this is a good time to pause. It's a good time to stop. If it feels like a shortcut and to get there, I'm going to have to kind of make a little compromise to what I believe. That is like all the warning lights on the dashboard should be going off, right? We find ourselves in these moments, all I got to do is just tell a little lie. Or more accurately, just not mention the whole truth. Right? All I've got to do is just blur the lines a little bit. All I got to do is tell myself, everybody does this kind of thing from time to time, or nobody's going to find out. See, and the momentum in this moment is in your favor, isn't it? Actually, it's harder to stop it. It's actually, to actually stop it, or to speak up, or to stand, or to raise the question, or to pause. It's a lot harder to do that than to just go with the momentum. So when those two things line up, that's like the perfect storm. And chances are you have examples of this in the past where you had that hesitation, but you saw the shortcut and you wanted it, and you just blew past your conscience or some moral, ethical boundaries. And maybe at the time it didn't seem like that big of a deal because, again, the opportunity, your friends, all that. But you look back on that now and you go, man, that cost me a lot. It cost you perhaps a job, relationships. It cost you reputation, integrity, people's trust. David does here what all of us should do in these moments, but this is really, really difficult for us to do. He stopped long enough to recognize that something doesn't seem quite right. There's a whisper that something was off. You know, oftentimes if we'll admit it, we recognize this, don't we? Like deep down, it's the only thing weighing in the other direction. But deep down, we have this sense of, I think something isn't quite right. I think I'm about to cross a line. And the reason we miss it is because we're so focused on what it is that we want. And we have these conversations to like, shh, our conscience. Yeah, it's not that big a deal. Nobody's going to find out. And after the way they treated me, or everybody does this. You know what's amazing to me is that even after we've kind of blown past that, we oftentimes still get a second chance before we've actually gone through with it. And here's the second chance. It's in the form of somebody saying something to you that reminds you of truth that you know, but you've been ignoring. What happens is we say, this is what we're, okay, be quiet. And we're going forward. And then the people in your life that, you know, you love and respect ask you, they meddle in your business, don't they? And they ask you really irritating, annoying questions like, would that be right? Like, would that be honest? Annoying questions like, what if so-and-so found out about this? Didn't you tell your parents that you wouldn't do that? Didn't you, like, sign a contract? Didn't you promise? By the way, anytime you find yourself making a decision and then wanting to avoid telling certain people about it because you don't want to hear what they're going to say, that is a huge warning sign. But again, the easiest thing in the world is to ignore this because our passions convince us that we're reading the tea leaves correctly, right? And really the farthest thing, we're not thinking accurately. We're not thinking clearly. What I just want you to understand from David's story is that in these moments when sometimes we're on the verge of making a really bad decision, oftentimes the only thing that keeps us from doing that is this tension, is the small voice of our conscience. And that's all we're going to get. The other thing that we, I think, learn from this story is, generally speaking, God is not in nearly as big of a hurry as we are. A lot of times I think we get ourselves in trouble because we have something that we want, and maybe that's a good thing. Maybe God even wants us to have it. We just want it now. And, you know, most of us, we're Americans, right? So we're going to get in there and we're going to make things happen and we're going to get this done and accomplish what we want to accomplish. And then an opportunity shows up and we're off to the races. Here's a fascinating thing about David's story. The urgency itself, the urgency of the circumstance caused David to think about something and to consider something he never would have considered under normal conditions. If you had gone to David the day before and said, hey, David, what do you think about maybe someday murdering King Saul? You think that's okay? David would have been like beside himself, like, God forbid such a thing. I mean, how dare you? I would never. It's the urgency of the circumstance in the first place that causes David to think about something and to get close to doing something he never, ever would have dreamed of doing. David's in this moment where he goes, I'll never get this opportunity again. And by the way, he's right. He never would get that opportunity again. David recognizes, though, that perhaps God has a better way of getting him from where he is to where he wants to be. So David decides, I'm going to trust that God's working in this. I'm going to trust God sees the bigger picture and that God is fully capable of getting me where he wants me to be in his own way without me stepping in and taking things into my own hands. Some of you, I suspect, are on the verge of making a big decision. You're at a crossroads. And I just want to say to you, perhaps, maybe you know this and it's part of the tension you feel, but perhaps more is at stake than you even realize. Perhaps you're about to set into motion a chain of events that cannot be reversed. And maybe you're here this morning and you're leaning in a certain direction. And maybe that's the right choice. But I've got a couple questions I just want to ask as we reflect on this. And I think we all owe it to ourselves to just stop and ask these three questions, okay? Before we move forward. I think these questions, if we're honest, can bring clarity where we most need it. Question number one, does the decision feel rushed? That's a clue. Here's another clue. Are people around you going repeatedly, you need to slow down. Slow down. Here's another clue. You find yourself in these conversations defending not the decision, but the urgency of the decision. You're not even talking about the thing. You're like, but it has to happen now, and this is why now is the right choice. I can't think of a time, hardly, when that, I mean, there are times when you should be urgent, I guess, like the building's on fire, feel some urgency. But that's not what we're talking about. Slow down is often the last thing we want to hear, but the thing that we need to hear most. I mean, you guys, you've lived life, many of you more than me. Haven't you discovered in your own life, and I tried really hard this week to think of an example against this. An exception. Haven't you guys found that if something is the right decision, it'll still be the right decision, like later? Like if it's the right decision now, it'll still be the right decision a week from now or a month from now? I think most of the time this can't wait, I'll never have the opportunity. David didn't have that other opportunity ever again either, and it was a good thing, right? Because it would have been a disaster. Just because it's now doesn't mean it's good. Many times it's just emotion. It's what we tell ourselves, the urgency to justify bad decisions. Or you have other people trying to put that on you, right? And maybe a decision does need to be made, but I have found that I don't have to necessarily agree with the timeline. I don't have to agree with the sense of urgency. Anytime I feel rushed in anything, for me, that's an indicator that I need to stop what I'm doing and to take a moment and to pause and to listen and to think more deeply. This is like, have you ever listened to one of those timeshare sales pitches? Okay, this is the whole thing. I mean, you know, you're going to get a free dinner or a hotel stay. All you got to do is listen to their 45. It is never 45 minutes, first of all. And you're listening, and what is the last thing that they want to hear? And they do everything they possibly can to make you make a decision right there in that initial setting. You know, 30 days to change your mind. You just lose your deposit if you do, or blah, blah, blah. The last thing they want to hear is you say this. I'm going to go home, and I'm going to take a couple days to think about this. Why do they not want you to say that? Because they know that with a little bit of time, and you're not rushing it, you will probably see more clearly and come to your senses, right? I'm sorry if you have a timeshare. I'm sure it's great. I'm sure it's awesome. Whenever we find ourselves saying anything like, I have to do this now, I'll never get another chance, again, that is a warning sign that we are quite possibly on the verge of making a big mistake. And now, you can make bad decisions slowly, right? That's true. But if you feel rushed, like something feels hurried, if it's the right decision, it'll still be the right decision in the future. Second question, are you feeling any tension around the decision you're leaning toward? And you know what your heart wants, you know what you're going after, and you know you've got your case built for going after that thing or making that decision. But is there anything in you that wants to just go, oh, I'm not quite, there's just a little bit of uneasiness. Or you don't want to tell so-and-so. And you tell yourself, the reason I don't want to tell so-and-so is because they don't get it. Well, they actually do get it. That's the problem. And the real reason you're not telling so-and-so is because what they're going to say is going to be the only other thing in the world matching up with what your conscience is telling you that you're trying to cover up or blow past or ignore. If you have any tension at all, I just want to clarify. That tension supersedes the circumstances. That should weigh more than the stars have aligned and all that wonderful stuff. That tension should weigh more than whatever signs or fleeces you put out and whatever it is you do to think that God talked to you. Okay. It should even weigh more than all the people in your life telling you who you picked, telling you, go for it, go for it, go for it. You can't go wrong. So listen to that. And by the way, you can have inner peace and still be nervous about something. You can have a sense God's calling you to take a risk, and because you don't know the future, that's maybe scary or uncertain, but you still have peace. And that's what we're going for, to be in a place where it's like, I have peace in the depths of who I am, and therefore, however things work out, I'm okay with. That is completely different than not having peace and thinking, I know this is gonna work. I got this. I'm in control of this. It's a completely different story. And then the last question, are you acting out of fear that if you don't make something happen, it's never going to happen? And part of making it happen for you, you recognize, involves cutting corners, compromising, violating in some way principles you know are important. You decided yourself are important. Now, I don't think that means we just sit back and God does everything for us. I think it's just stopping and saying, is it possible that God sees things I can't see? That he has a vantage point on my life, getting me from A to B, where I'm trying to get, that he sees opportunities and he sees people and he sees chances that I can't see in this moment. All I can see is this thing's in front of me, I better grab it or it'll never happen. Do you believe God might have a better way of getting you from here to there? That he can orchestrate things in a much better way than we can? Because if you don't, you'll be much more likely to just get a death grip on these things yourself. So to end all this, some of you have hated this whole thing, right? Because you've got like papers sitting on your desk at home. And you've already decided what you're gonna do. And for some reason you haven't signed them, right? Or whatever, or some other decision, you've set a plan in motion. And just hearing this makes you go, you know, there is some tension there. And I've been trying to sell myself on this thing. And I also feel like I've got to decide right this second, and it's a huge rush. So basically everything that I've been saying. If that's you, you can be mad that you came to church today. That's okay. Be mad at me. I'm fine with that. But don't you owe it to yourself to be honest about that? That maybe you are trying to force something to happen, that there is some tension, and that you are in a huge rush. Don't you owe it to yourself to just admit that? To consider the implications, to slow down, to let God speak. All right, it's up to you, right? It's up to you. Would you stand? We'll pray. Heavenly Father, Lord, we desperately want the wisdom, the clarity, and the courage to make good choices, especially in these critical or crossroads moments where the path that we go down has some real implications. We desperately need to hear from you. And so, Lord, I pray that for those of us in a moment like this, a decision in front of us, that you'd help us to see clearly. Lord, some of us, we have examples, situations right now where, I mean, the momentum is already pushing us in a direction. We're already almost there, but it's not too late. Help us to be honest about the fact that beneath all of that excitement and hype and energy and emotion and adrenaline, there's some tension within us. There's some uneasiness. We recognize that we're going to have to compromise who you want us to be, our integrity, our character. So Lord, help us to admit that, help us to pause, help us to, if we're in a rush, to stop what we're doing, to listen, to be honest, to listen to the people you have put in our lives who we've been avoiding. God, we want to honor you with our lives, with our choices. We want the sum total of our lives to reflect you and who you are. So help us to do that with the choices in front of us now. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, thanks for being here. It's always good to worship with you. Have a great week, and I will see you next time.